the channel on YouTube. The guy is absolutely marvelous. He is good and he is crazy expensive. But he made that video that there was 11 million people who watched that video. And that video brought attention of the professor who lost $10,000. And then we have, I remember one guy was, one other professor was working at DARPA. The other one was the MIT professor of physics. Then we had two others. And they were supposed to be judges in that deal. So the propeller is attached to the chain, through the chain, to the wheels. The propeller turns not the way that the propeller turns in the airplane. It turns the other way. So when we push that vehicle, then the propeller turns because it's attached with the chain to the wheels. And then we have a right wing. That propeller starts to turn, and you may think about inertia. At some point, there is too much of inertia, and the vehicle is gonna go faster than the wind. But it's not the case. So you need to watch the video. As Dr. Roy said, he didn't take the chance to explain the story. Even Dr. Roy, who has excellent English and a beautiful way of painting pictures with words.
It's mostly about language, what people understand, what books they read, what TV they watch, what music they listen to, all adds up to some memory, you know, of language.
Just a right.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed, what would you like to add to this?
I'm kind of lurking in the background just listening, and Wesley is talking about an experiment where you have a propeller turning in the wind, and it's connected to a chain drive or something, some wheels. My question is it a fixed pitch propeller? Is it a variable pitch propeller? Is there any kind of a transmission in between the propeller and the wheels? Is there any kind of a system to keep the propeller pointed in the right direction relative to the wind? These are some questions I have.
Okay, the propeller is attached to the shaft. The shaft has a gearing on it, one gear only. That gear is connected to the wheels. So when the propeller turns, the wheels must turn, or if you push the wheels, the propeller will move. But the propeller will move counterclockwise. That means it will not move to propel, but actually the other way, the opposite way. Now, if you want to see that video is there are a series of videos. So the first video title with Veritasium on YouTube is Risking My Life to Settle a Physics Debate. That's the title, Risking My Life to Settle a Physics Debate. And you're going to see the Veritasium video. The second one was after 11 million of views, when Veritasium really paid big bucks to make that video, and there was like a crew of 11 people in it. So I assume that was a quite expensive. He had a sponsor at that time. From what I know, it was about $50,000 of the cost for that to make. So that was sponsored, or partially sponsored, the video. The second video was triggered by the first video. A physics professor bet me $10,000 if I'm wrong. Again, the title is, A Physics Professor Bet Me $10,000 If I'm Wrong. And that's very title. And the third one is Building the Vehicle Physics Calls Impossible. That is on the channel of Tia. I don't know how to say it properly. That's a half Chinese, half white girl. Amazing personality. Amazing. Many people would be really shocked with her knowledge. Okay, I hope that is an open time. So when you look at it, those three videos, it's like a saga. Then you're going to understand everything. And the judgment of three other professors was that the professor that made the bet was wrong and he had to pay $10,000. So he paid the $10,000. But Veritasium, who probably has plenty of money already, is not donated. He actually made another set of videos. He said, three people who sent me counterintuitive videos or projects, they're going to receive the $10,000 money. So that's the whole story. Back to you.
When you operate from memory, then there is no intuition there.
Well, that's a good point. That's all right.
Yes, AC2GS here. Look, we're coming up to 1016. We're going to have to tie this up in a bow and let Paul do his thing. I will post the three links on my link page, again, roy.ac2gs.com. And you can look at the YouTube videos in the privacy of your own boudoir. And if anyone wants to chat about it next week, why not? How's that?
Okay. I'll be 5 minutes. Can I have 5 minutes? That's all right?
Okay. 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, we can leave it to the next week. We have Euler. So it is a Swedish Artemis Technologies company that made the Euler, which is a boat, but a boat is not submerged in the water, and it's not flying either. The easy way to describe that is you have a small keel, long one actually, and that keel is a T-shape and has a motor on it, and that motor is underwater, is electric, and that motor is actually pushing the boat to be over the water, so the keel is only in the water and is reaching the speed of 32 miles, but other boilers could reach 55 miles. So the world speed record was 45 knots or 53 knots speed. That is not a new project, it's about 100 years old project that is constantly discussed by very narrow people, narrow group of fans.
Wesley?
Okay, so that would be next week. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Wesley. My problem with the video on that subject is It sort of reminds me, the boat is very similar to the guy that did the introduction for the TechNet tonight. Neither of them really exist. That video is not a video of an actual object. It's a 3D presentation, and 3D presentations can be problematic.
I must disagree. That's what you saw. Yes, it was 3D presentation, but actually they have a plug that's supposed to be ended in 2023, which is the end of the year. They received 60 million euros for it. The government of Ireland is involved in it, and although the project is not new, there are plenty of other boats of this sort. They were able to attract them. They want to have a ferry whatsoever. There is plenty of information about it. Just a few words before we start to talk about the next week.
Well, my problem is that, once again, there are 3D simulations of the Hyperloop. There have been many millions of dollars invested in the development of the Hyperloop. The Hyperloop was a failure. The Hyperloop is pretty much dead. All that's left behind is you go to Las Vegas and you can drive a Tesla car in a dangerous tunnel underground for a short distance. And if you're stuck there, lots of luck. So there's a lot of things that could be 3D simulated. There are a lot of things that venture capitalists will throw money at the drop of a hat. That doesn't mean they're real. Well, we can discuss it next week, because I really want to go to the SpaceNet report. Okay, Wesley?
Yeah, I wonder if Paul has time to say a few words about that material that I have sent to you. Thank you very much. Enjoy it here.
You're welcome, Wesley. Thank you for your participation. Well, it's 10:21, a little late, but what can I tell you? I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope you liked the little technical demonstration. Tried to do it last Sunday, but the All-Star link was down for some strange reason. I don't quite know what was going on there. Also, IRLP seemed to be down last week, but IRLP is alive and well, and John from Los Alamos, hello. And we have IRLP link with our Ontario, Canada repeater in Barrie, Ontario. So hello out there. And thanks again, everyone. Please come back next Sunday when we'll do this all over again. But right now it's time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, 2GS, WS2N. For the SpaceNet report for the TechNet, very good on everything tonight. And I'm not much of a YouTube person either, like the other guy said. I'd rather read the material. Good book, by the way, is Thinking Physics. So, you know, they have all that stuff. And I think if you read that, you're really going to doubt some of these claims that these people make. Whether or not they're true or not, I don't know, but I haven't seen the videos yet. We'll look into it. Anyway, the Chandrayaan 3 spacecraft is doing very well. That's the one from India. I know I've talked about it for quite a few weeks. Landed last week. And when it did, it became another country that successfully landed on the moon. They joined the United States, Russia, and China. But they have two vehicles that have been on that moon right now. The lander and the Pragon rover. The lander is being used as a relay station. It's the rover transmits to the lander, and the lander turns around and transmits back to the NASA Deep Space Network. And just recently, India got involved with signing the Artemis Accord, which indirectly allows them to certain NASA amenities such as the Deep Space Network. So they didn't have to devise their own for this. But anyway, it's very successful. I put two pictures up on Dr. Roy's website. One picture is of the lander itself taken from the Fragon rover. Fragon rover on Earth weighs around 60 pounds. On the Moon, it's around 10 pounds. You know, and it's a six-wheel vehicle. You know, it has a solar panel on it. It's got a couple of navigation cameras. This way it could do some autonomous driving. It knows when to stop in front of a crater, which it did. Another crater just rode right through because I guess it knew how deep it was. It just kept on going. And they use this bogey rocker system for the wheels. So, you know, they've all copied it from our rovers. The first one that we had on Mars was the Sojourner. And that one was as big as a larger microwave oven. And that one had the six wheels on it as well. And it worked so well that they've used it ever since. They used it on the Spirit rover on Mars and the Opportunity rover on Mars, and now they're using it on they're using it on Curiosity and Perseverance as well. Those two are still operational. But you can see that diagram of what the little rover looks like. I sent that to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs.com. Bring that up, and you can see the diagram of the rover, and you can see a picture of the lander. I put this on a few days ago, but looking on the internet, it was getting almost impossible to find any pictures that were being released. But I finally found one, and now, sure enough, there's a couple more that they put out. Let me drop it. Oh, you know, they should be able to operate for a couple more days until dark on the moon. The moon has 14 days of daylight, 14 days of night. So once nighttime comes, they predict that the rover and the lander will come to an end, and you won't have enough heat to keep the batteries warm. And I mean, there is an outside chance that it might come back after 14 days, but of course that's doubtful. But that wasn't the plan. The plan was to, you know, successfully land on the moon, do some scientific evaluations. They have a probe that goes about 10 centimeters, about 4 inches into the soil, into the regolith on the moon, and takes temperatures. That information is all being sent back to Mission Control over in India. Let me drop it. Okay, another station broken up. I don't know if it was you or something wrong with my bonding control, but try again. This is Paul, WS2N.
Hooked up to BXO with a comment, Ken.
Okay, Frank, very good. Yeah, usually you're more solid coming in, but yes, that transmit. Go ahead, Frank.
You're breaking up a little bit also, so I don't know whether I didn't reconnect my but they usually are by this time of night anyway, and that's usually not the issue. In any case, the original rover design, I remember seeing a documentary that just came from the, I believe that came from the lunar design from the Apollo year, that after the fall of the Soviet Union, those engineers presumably came to the United States and showed our guys how to build a rover. That's one version that I've seen anyway. Go ahead.
Okay, again, a little breaking up. Somebody came over from somewhere and started building the rover. You're talking about the early rovers that we built, Sojourner, that landed with the Pathfinder on Mars, that one. That's all. They got involved with, early on with General Motors, they were doing some work with them. So I'm missing really what you're saying, Frank. I'm going to turn it back to you again. Try again.
Yeah, I'll send it in the chat, the echo link comments if this doesn't work. What I said was I understand that the design originally came from the Russians' Lunokhod design, the Russians' moon car design, which dates back to the Apollo era. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, Lunokhod. Lunokhod had 8 wheels. That was successful. I think they had 3 of them that rode around on the moon, and the last one sent back samples back to the Russians. They had a sample return mission on that one. But that didn't have the bogey system. They didn't have the system where, let's say on the right wheels, if something went up, over a rock, no matter what they did, the body itself, the square piece. If you're looking at it, that would stay level. The wheels would be moving, but the body itself would not shift because they had a linkage between the right hand side and the left hand side. So I mean that's the American design. I don't know if the Russians had that. I'd have to look at some of their drawings. I don't think so. But they had 8 wheels for some reason. So and now everybody, including China, using 6 wheels on their rovers. But the most important part is that this bogey situation. They copied it from the trains. The subway. You go down to the subway system. The carriage underneath. They took it from that kind of a design where each, let's say the front section, the wheels of one car has like 4 wheels on it. The back of that also has 4 wheels on it. Those 4 wheels are like a bogey type of design as well, where if, let's say one wheel tends to go off the track, it still has another one on it, sitting on the track. This way it pretty much keeps the car steady. They stole it from that idea. That's what I heard. Anyway, anything else, Frank? Back to you.
Yeah, I just tuned in, so I don't know. Have you gotten to SpaceX to Starship yet, or that?
No, not yet. I've been reading a lot about it, but they look like they're pretty much ready. But they need an FAA approval. They haven't gotten that yet. I think once they got that, I think within a week or two they'll try launching that. But we'll go back to that again, Frank. Yeah, right now we were doing India's topic, and India was so successful they decided to launch another rocket, this time to investigate the sun. I mean, that's the way they make it seem like on the news. Meanwhile, they've had this thing planned for years. This thing going to the sun, to investigate the sun, was planned years ago. It has really nothing to do with the timing of Chandrayaan 3 being successfully landed on the moon. But a day or two ago, they launched another rocket from India, the PSLV satellite launch vehicle. They have two main vehicles, rockets in India, the PSLV, the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, which is a medium to heavy type of launch vehicle, and that's the one that they just launched this solar probe, solar telescope to. They launched it to the L1 position, Lagrange point one, which is roughly 1,000,000 miles away from Earth, about 4 times the distance away from the moon, but in the direction of the sun. So it goes into a heliocentric orbit. And again, I saw this on the news, and it made it seem like this is the only time it's been done. It's been done for decades, many, many decades. We've been doing it. Our European Space Agency has done it. We have the ACE solar scope out there decades ago, and European Space Agency has the SOHO, and now even SpaceX launched the Discover satellite for NASA. It's another one out there at that location, and now it's going to be joined by another one from India, and they'll find out if they're successful. If they are, it'll study the sun, and which is good. You know, the information will be shared with the United States as well. The spacecraft will take a long time to get there. I think they said roughly 4 months before it actually gets there. The reason it takes so long is they launch from Earth, and they make it where they put enough fuel in it in that rocket, or enough push anyway. There's plenty of fuel, but enough push where eventually it starts slowing down. When it leaves Earth, it's going 25,000 miles an hour. When you leave the gravity well of Earth, and then as it travels and it gets further and further away from Earth, eventually it starts slowing down, and it slows down to 20,000, 10,000. Eventually it gets down like 4,000 miles an hour or so. But by the time it gets all the way out to this 1,000,000 miles from Earth, it's really slowed down. I mean, it really gets down to practically nothing, down to like 100 miles an hour, down to 50 miles an hour. And then, it's similar to throwing a ball up in the air on Earth. You can throw it up. Just when it gets to apex, that's what they want to do. This way you don't need a lot of fuel on board. When it gets to that L1 position, if it's long at, let's say, 5,000 or 10,000 miles an hour when you get there, you'd have to have a lot of fuel on board to slow it down to get it into that orbit. Sure, you would get there quicker, but it would also be a lot more expensive and very impractical to have such a large vehicle, large rocket. You wouldn't need it. This one is being done with their, let's call it, medium lift rocket, the PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. The one that went to the moon, that's a lot more weight. The lander and the rover, they all weigh quite a bit. They needed to have enough fuel enough weight, a lot of mass on that vehicle. Whatever that vehicle weighed, double that amount, the amount of fuel. So you needed a real heavy lift launch vehicle. So instead of the PSLV, they have the GSLV, the geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. It's their real heavy lift vehicle in India. And that's what they used to go to the moon. So. They're doing good. They have a manned space program that's being developed within a year or so. They're testing now. They have a 3-crew vehicle they're working on. But within a year or so, they might be able to do some testing. They want to launch it unmanned first. Maybe within a year and a half, 2 years, they might be able to launch a crew into orbit. And if they do that, that'll be, they'll join the other 3 countries that could do it, United States, Russia, and China. We're the only ones that have done that. Even the European Space Agency with their launch facility down in French Guiana have not launched people. They've launched, heavy lift vehicles from that place, but they haven't put people on board yet. Any comments? WS20. All right, before I go over to Wesley's topic, there's a crew that's on its way back from the International Space Station. crew of four astronauts NASA's bringing home. They've been up there for like 6 months. It's called Crew 6. It was the sixth scheduled crew to actually go to the International Space Station that NASA was behind. There was another one, a test flight early on, that just sent two people up to the space station for a test on a crew Dragon. So, I mean, in reality, this is like the seventh vehicle that they've done for NASA. There's two other ones that have also gone up by Axiom. That's private, completely private. So, you know, anyway, NASA really only cares about their own missions. That's the ones they're paying for. The other ones, Axiom, when they go up, Axiom is actually paying NASA for some of the uses of the International Space Station facility. But anyway, they'll be coming back at 12:07 tonight. So after the net, I'll probably stay up and bring up the NASA channel. And they'll probably, I'm sure by that time the crew will be on its way back. It'll take them roughly about an hour and a half after firing their retro rockets to enter the atmosphere. And last time I looked, they were planning on landing in the Atlantic Ocean. And they have a backup in the Gulf of Mexico that they use as well. So I'm not sure where they're going to land tonight. They were supposed to land a couple days ago, but because of the hurricane that went through and it created rough waves, and it wasn't wind, it was the waves that held off the return, so they spent another day or two up there. They'll be back tonight. And that will leave, instead of 11 people on board, you're going to have now 7 people on board. That's the standard number. Any comments or questions? Okay, let's go over to Wesley's topic. He mailed an email to me dealing with a project that was canceled many years ago, and it was called the X-34 project, and it was an unmanned program that was supposed to be used for suborbital missions. Anyway, like anything else, they kind of like ran out of money. But I think Wesley wanted to talk about it. Where this thing wound up. He said somebody's backyard. I read it was in a crane. Some company that owns a crane business. Anyway, where some of the these old failed, or not failed, but pieces of equipment wind up, they all don't wind up, I guess, in the junk pile. Back to you, Wesley. Over to you, WS. Hello, Wesley. I put him to sleep. Oh, no. And to H-A-N, WS. Okay, that's the way it goes. Anyway, he had a good topic about this vehicle. And he wanted to talk about the X-37B as well, and which I understand. This is an extension of what they were trying to do with the X-34. X-34, the one that was canceled back in, I guess, the early 2000s. Was supposed to be taken up to altitude, roughly 45,000 feet in the air, by an L-10 11, a Lockheed L-10 11, heavy lift airplane. You have the 747. Well, Lockheed had the L-10 11. That was their version, and they. Whatever they made is not flying anymore, except for this one. This one was being flown by Orbital Science was the name of the company. And they were the ones developing the X-34 for NASA.
And, you know, they were coming along, but they never got a chance to test it. It was supposed to be able to go to Mark, Mark 8 or something. They wanted to get up to real high speeds, maybe 50 miles into the air. And then it would come back down and land on a runway. And if that worked out, they were going to either use that one or probably, you know, a version of it in the future. And again, they would go to suborbital flight, not orbital, and they would get that high or maybe a little higher. And then they would have payload doors open up, and you would have another booster, you know, probably a solid booster or maybe another chemical rocket, you know, push a payload to orbit. So the idea was to create a cheap way to orbit. And, you know, they predicted that launching this X-34 would cost around $500,000. But it never happened. You know, now Wesley mentioned the X-37B. X-37B is a very successful program. Also, this one's by Boeing. And it's really, again, an extension of the same idea. But instead of putting it onto an airplane, either a 747 or an L-1011 or B-52, they launched the X-37B on a rocket. And the early plans were successful. They put it onto the Atlas V rocket and launched the earlier ones in space. And now when they went up, they would stay for like months at a time. Then they would stay for a year and then multiple years. There's two of these things that have been built, the X-37Bs. They take turns. So one will go up for a couple of years, stay in orbit, come back down, land. The early flights landed in, on the space shuttle runways, and then they had the earliest one, I think, landed in California and Edwards Air Force Base. So very successful. There's one up there now, and it's been up there for almost 600 days now, and I predict it'll probably be up there for maybe another year before they bring that one down. When they do, they'll send another one up. Now, these things, the X-37B, which is put inside of an Atlas V rocket, and by the way, they've also launched it on a Falcon 9 as well. They have that capability. They have launched two of these, I believe, on the Falcon 9 rocket. And once they get to orbit, they probably use them for spy satellites. They really don't talk much about it. NASA has put some test equipment on board. The last one, because they're well known. I mean, when they were being built, people didn't even notice these were being built. It was like top secret. But now they know what it is and what it's doing. They don't tell you exactly what it's doing. It's all, you know, controlled by DARPA and National Reconnaissance Office. The good thing is now is the money that's used for this. You know, these things cost, you know, probably $100 million to launch something like this. In fact, I think Atlas V is probably around, used to be around $180 million to launch something. So it costs big bucks to launch something, but none of this money is coming out of NASA. In fact, this wasn't even developed by NASA. I mean, NASA was able to give them plenty of advice. Boeing built it with funds from the Defense Department. That's what I'm saying. There's really two space agencies, you might call it, in this country. There's NASA, and then there's the Defense Department, which, you know, is consisted of DARPA and National Reconnaissance Office and things like that. And NASA is separate. And I read years ago that the budget on the military side for the space program is twice the budget of what NASA gets. So NASA gets all the publicity, you know, makes the news.
there's problems. They people find out about it, but it's not. There's been some other surveillance, spy satellite or something like that. Most of the time, so I don't even think it makes the news. Any comments? WS2R. Okay. Talking about the Defense Department, they really would like to have a company or two be able to, on short notice, launch a satellite into space, a spy satellite or something that detects nuclear bombs, or, they would like to, have a satellite immediately launched on short notice. And the reason for it is, theoretically, if there was a problem, either with, asteroids, knocking our satellites out of orbit, or a country that's not friendly to the United States decides to knock out a satellite or two in orbit, or maybe a satellite just failed. Maybe there's a, some kind of a solar flare that's going to knock a bunch of satellites out. The Defense Department would like to get one or two in orbit, like within days, right away. Which is, going to be a great thing in the future. That thought of, what happens if we lose our satellites? They're developing a system. They have been for probably the last 10 years that I know of, probably thinking about it even before that, to have satellites put into space very quickly. Now, they've contracted with the Firefly Aerospace Company. Firefly has flown two times. They have the Firefly rocket that they call the Alpha rocket that they launched a couple times from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And they're coming along, perfecting it each time they do a launch. But they've already contracted with the government to see if they would be ready to launch a satellite. Now, they don't necessarily build satellites, but they build the rockets. But they also contracted with a company called Millennium Space Systems, which builds satellites real quick. So they contacted both of these. They put them on notice from now until within 6 months. They're already in a test mode right now. So one day, within the next 6 months, they're going to get a call from, I guess, DARPA, from the government, and they're going to say, okay, now we need a satellite put up there now. So 1, 2, 3, Millennium Space Systems will put together a satellite and have it shipped over to Firefly, which is over in their launch facility for now anyway, is in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They'll be able to ship a satellite over to them, and then they'll be able to launch it. They're hoping they could be able to do this within three days or so. They said 60 hours, but, within 3 days, if they could do that, the government will be very happy, and I'm sure they'll run further tests in the future. And my guess is they'll probably also come up with another company that will be able to do the same thing, to be able to get something ready quick, put it into space within a short moment notice. So I thought that was pretty cool. Any comments? This is WS2N for the Space Night Report. Okay. My radio unkeyed. There's another launch coming up very shortly that NASA would like to see done. It's not a manned mission. It's a communication system. This will be launched in November. They're going to use a Dragon. Not a Dragon. A Falcon 9 rocket to put this vehicle up to the International Space Station. I believe it's going to be in the it's going to be stored in the unpressurized area of a Dragon spacecraft. So after it's launched, it'll be attached to the International Space Station, or a robotic arm will pull this thing out. It's called the ILLUMA, I-L-L-U-M-A. Essentially what it is, it's a laser communication device. Transmits infrared laser. So the idea is to be able to have very quick communications with Earth, but be able to transmit a lot of gigabytes in very short time, maybe 3 or 4 times faster than what you can do with RF. So they already have another one of these similar things already in a geosynchronous orbit going around the Earth. So the idea would be to transmit from the space station up to the geosynchronous orbit and then back down to either New Mexico or California, which they have receivers, and then be able to transmit in the other direction as well. So the idea is to create optical transmission instead of RF. And, I mean, they have a long-term goal of doing many of these things. But, of course, this is all going to be a test. And to supplement it, it'll never replace, but the idea will be to supplement the TDRS system. The TDRS system is the tracking data relay system, tracking data relay satellite system that has been developed since the early 80s. The first one was launched early on an unmanned rocket, and then eventually they put they call that TDRS A, and then eventually when it went to orbit, it becomes one. The second one that was supposed to go up wound up on as a payload on the Challenger when that went up. Unfortunately, that one, of course, didn't make it. So that was a shame. And in the future, they did launch future TDRS satellites. You would have at least 3 up there. You really need 4. One is a spare to make this work. And each one was in geosynchronous orbit. So this way, when a satellite, like a space shuttle, is going around orbit, or a satellite like the Hubble Space Telescope, they want to transmit data. They transmit directly up to the TDRS satellite in geosynchronous orbit, and they transmit it back down to Earth. This was a big improvement in doing that over what they originally had. They had ground stations all around the Earth, like 20 or 30 of these ground stations. And they would fly around from one ground station, they'd go over Bermuda, and then they'd go over another one. It takes you 90 minutes to go all the way around Earth, an hour and a half. Go make one orbit around Earth. With that system in place before TDRS, all these ground stations, you only had a total of 15 minutes of communication with a spacecraft, or eventually, Skylab and all these. You had nothing but problems. It wasn't until after Skylab that they realized that you're going to need something better than what they had. Sure enough, TDRS replaced that, but it's all RF. So with all the experiments and things going on station, hundreds of experiments going on a regular basis day after day, tremendous amount of data. It's not just video, coming back, the astronauts, giving an interview on a NASA event, for a TV station somewhere. But it's all this data, all the science data, and tons of data have to be constantly transmitted back down to Earth. And they would like to be able to increase the volume that they send. So if this would work, and they could, do this all optically with these infrared lasers, that would be a big improvement. Anyway, that's the story with that. Any other comments? Put in at this WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Yes, WB2BX. No, with a question. If you copy, maybe okay.
Yeah, that's a 100% copy this time. Okay, something weird happened earlier tonight. But anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, now, I've heard this before. You can get incredible data rates with laser. And I know that's the basics for fiber optics as well as for some of the space communications. But I'm still a little confused because lasers are very narrow banded, and we all know as radio amateurs that your data rate is related to your bandwidth. so do you have any idea how that works with a laser? Go ahead, because you still have to have some bandwidth, even though it's light, and not strictly speaking RF, it still obeys the same rules, which is electromagnetic signal. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, well, I guess they have, I really don't know, basically how the laser communication system works, but I'm guessing they have to have, you know, basically set the frequency, you know, and with light, and create a bandwidth that way. You know, they go by nano. They don't use frequency. They call it a nanometer range. Regular light is 500 or something. I forget the numbers, but anyway, whatever the infrared is, that would be great. You know, because the frequencies are so high, you're going to get, you know, many gigahertz. They'd say at least three times more. Right, and then this in the beginning when they, when they were experimenting with this. Now they've tested it. They had put a spacecraft in orbit around the moon that had a transmitter on board, and it was able to transmit a short video back to Earth all the way from the moon. So they've tested that already, so they know that capability is coming up in the future as well. The Psyche mission, which is going to be launched in October, has a transmitter on board as well. Not a receiver, but a transmitter. And that'll be transmitting some data once it gets out to the asteroid that's going to visit the asteroid belt many years from now, but it's going to be launched this October. And that's going to have an infrared transmitter as well. And as far as I know, the only two receivers that they use right now, one is in California and the other one is in New Mexico. But for the space station, they actually have transmitters as well, so they're going to transmit up to the space station. They'll transmit up to the geosynchronous satellite, and then from there it'll be sent back down to the ISS. So, I'm sure Roy or one of the other guys know the technical end of how the bandwidth works for optical. Anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, okay, very good. I have to clear and do some other things here. But thanks very much, and maybe we'll continue this discussion next time, and I will try to watch the Crew 6 landing before I sack out also. Cert 3, WB2BXO.
Very good, Frank. Thanks for the question. And yeah, that's 1 hour from now they should land. I'll turn it on after this. Roy, I'm going to turn it back to you. Anybody that's listening, we'll be on tomorrow again at 8:30 on these repeaters for the Club InfoNet. That's followed by the Swap and Shop. If you want to buy something or sell something. Roy, over to you. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, C2GS here. Well, our rebels now are done. Paul, thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a technical net. Hope you found the technical demonstration interesting. I spent some time on that. And I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were amused by a few things. And I hope you'll join us in future outings. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., except for the last two Sundays of September, where I won't be, but I'll be back after that as well. And I'll be back next week as well. So once again, I'd like to leave people with a couple of quotes. Zig, K2RIW, who ran this show for many decades, ended his technical net with, be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. And I like to quote Epictetus. He was a Roman philosopher. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So, keep your mind open and be ready to learn new things. Be ready to unlearn a few things that you mislearned. I hope you all have a great remaining Labor Day. I hope you have loads of fun. And as always, I hope you come back and join us. And as I finish up tonight's Labor Day edition of the Limebark Technical Net, as always, Slava Ukraine. This is AC2GS, and I am clear.
This is KD2VHD, Jim. I'm still here, and I will bring that discussion up next week.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.